Blog Talk Radio.
Well, the Republicans replaced and canceled and replaced Obamacare. So if that's a big deal to you, it should be a big deal to everybody. Unbelievably so. I've got a clip here of this for you. The internet's super slow today for some reason, but I'm continue to close Windows, hoping it'll kind of pep it up, but here we go.
Lee Carter, good to have you both with us.
Great to be here.
As we await the president, Rachel was making me crow, as I promised I would, because the speaker moved the bill through, and the president is talking about a unified party tonight, which is a wonderful thing.
That's right. And he had a party in the Rose Garden to celebrate it. It was a big day for the Republicans to come together. I don't think anybody expected it to happen this week. I think that we've all been saying, you know, it keeps getting kicked down the road. It's never going to happen. And when Donald Trump came out and said, it's going to happen next week, everybody thought there's no way. And here we are.
When you say everybody,
not you. Not you, Lou. I know.
No, but I'm serious. This is a president who's starting to say things. And people understand that no matter how radical and how unlikely, they're going to happen. There's a real confidence building, I think, Randy. Your thoughts?
Well, mine is that winners know how to win.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump is a winner, and he's teaching the Republicans how to win. Remember, they've been out of power, and they're now just suddenly coming to grips with the idea that the way you win is you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing, because in the end, meritocracy means good ideas carry the day. You don't give up if you have a setback. You don't give up if you have a pushback. You just keep marching forward. And what they've learned is this president isn't going to accept anything other than a win.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's another very important ingredient in this, which I know you're aware of and respect. And that is that when you're representing 63 million people who voted for you and 315 million Americans of every size, stripe, and persuasion, you've got a special imprimatur that says you represent the people of the United States as president. And it's taken a while. I truly believe for the leadership of both the Senate and the House, the Republican Party, to understand this man is the president. They've got a lovely job. But Paul Ryan received only 230,000 votes, the president almost 63 million.
And I think it's really hard for most politicians in Washington, D.C. to understand that they keep their promises. They run on something, they're actually going to do what they say they're going to do, and they're not necessarily in it for a popularity contest. I think one of the things about President Trump that has been so refreshing is he's not sitting there saying, I'm trying to get 75% approval in the polls. He's saying, I'm trying to deliver to the American people what I promised I was going to deliver to the American people. That's tax reform. That's health care. That's jobs. That's economic and growth. And he's saying it might not be popular with everybody, but it's the right thing for our country.
You know, you can actually, I believe that it's visible to watch Chuck Schumer after that display of just some of the most awful, ugly moments in Senate history. Is he opposed the president? I understand the opposition of the party, the Democratic Party, but he took it to a level of combat. And nasty. He broke every Geneva Convention there is when it comes to proper treatment of a respected president.
But the president rose above all that. Yeah. I mean, did we hear about a government shutdown this week? No. Why?
Not from the president.
Not from the president. Did we hear about the passage of a health care bill? Yes. Are we moving forward consistently?
I've got to correct myself. We did hear from the president. He used it as a threat against his own party to say,
right,
maybe what we need here is a good government shutdown to break the nonsense and the orthodoxy and this ossified attitude that's grown up, which, frankly, you were just describing. That is, politicians in the House and the Senate, are used to being elected and then their promises being forgotten.
All right, so let's take a little break here. I'm trying to get this computer up and running. I think the internet as a whole is going a little bit slow. So that Trump and the GOP passed repeal and pass measure on Obamacare, and now it has to get through the Senate, which is a completely different undertaking. Right here, I got some more West Montgomery for you. It'll play for us. 7-Eleven, Amos Cruz is AM 1450, 523 1450. And it's a little bit slow, so let me just hit the ads and we'll be right back. All right, so let me cover some headlines for you. The healthcare deal is overturned. Obamacare is overturned. Stephen Jaffe challenging Nancy Pelosi. He's an employment attorney and a Democrat. Wall Street Journal scope of federal probe into Fox News broadens. Network sued again. I undoubtedly, they're going to go after him for breaking the laws on equal protection and also how women are treated. FBI officers depolicing. FBI states officers across the United States are depolicing as hostility becomes the new norm. ISIS using ads on Craigslist to lure hostages and murder victims. YouTube targets TV's breadbasket with 40 new original shows. That's unbelievable. Let's see what else here. North Korea accuses U.S. South Korea of assassination attempts, biochemical weapons. And the French election is coming up. The Kardashians are in free fall, thank God. And 523-1450 to call in. All right, let me give you a little. I want to focus on the first hour on what's in the new healthcare bill for you so you're informed. 617, here we go.
I want to thank Paul Ryan. He has worked so hard. And I was joking. I said, you know, Paul, for the last week, I've been hearing Paul Ryan doesn't have it. It's not working with Paul Ryan. He's going to get rid of Paul Ryan. Then today I heard Paul Ryan's a genius. He's come along. You know, the groups have all come together. We have the Tuesday group. We have so many groups. We have the Freedom Caucus. We have, and they're all great people. But we have a lot of groups, but they all came together. Really, Paul, I'd say in the last 3-4 days, especially in the last day, I see Mark and I see Kevin, I see so many people, Jim, we just have developed a bond. This has really brought the Republican Party together. As much as we've come up with a really incredible health care plan, this has brought the Republican Party together. We're going to get this finished, and then we're going, as you know, we put our tax plan in. It's a massive tax cut, the biggest tax cut in the history of our country. I used to say the biggest since Ronald Reagan. Now it's bigger than that. Also, pure tax reform. So we're going to get that done next. And this really helps it. A lot of people said, how come you kept pushing healthcare, knowing how tough it is? Don't forget, Obamacare took 17 months. Hillary Clinton tried so hard, really valiantly, in all fairness, to get healthcare through. Didn't happen. We've really been doing this for 8 weeks, if you think about it. And this is a real plan. This is a great plan. And we had no support from the other party. So I just want to introduce somebody to say a few words who really has been, I think, treated very unfairly, but it no longer matters because we won and we're going to finish it off and we're going to go on to a lot of other things. And we are going to have a tremendous 4 years, and maybe even more importantly, we're going to have a tremendous 8 years, but we're going to start off with just a great first year. And
all right, so that's that from the president. What's in the Republican bill? I got a couple of clips, one from Chris, what's his face from Cross Fox News, Chris Wallace, and then from Rush Limbaugh, so check it out.
President Trump is halfway toward fulfilling a major campaign promise, getting rid of Obamacare. The House passed health care reform this afternoon, culminating a weeks-long internal battle for the GOP.
This is a great plan. I actually think it will get even better. And this is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it.
But as tough as it was to get the bill through the House today, it may be even tougher to get it through the Senate. We have Fox team coverage. Trish Regan in New York with the economic impact of the reform bill. John Roberts also in New York as the president takes a victory lap. But we begin with Chief Congressional Correspondent Mike Emanuel at the Capitol tonight to tell us what's in the new bill and what's next. Good evening, Mike.
Chris, good evening. The vote was 217 to 213 with 20 Republicans voting against the bill. It was just enough to pass. House Speaker Paul Ryan put everything on the line to keep the promise of scrapping Obamacare.
Let's put the patient, not the bureaucrats, at the center of the system.
Ryan's top lieutenant, the House Majority Leader, said Congress is obligated to take action.
Doing nothing leaves too many Americans out in the cold. And Mr. Speaker, we will not stand for that. We tried the Obamacare way. It is failing remarkably.
The House Republican plan would give states more flexibility to go after premium costs. It would stop Medicaid expansion and require those who are able-bodied to work. It would include refundable tax credits for those who don't receive insurance from their employer. It would expand health savings accounts designed to give consumers greater choice and flexibility in buying coverage. And it would defund Planned Parenthood for 1 year, blocking more than $500 million federal dollars.
And our bill actually rescues families by focusing on lowering premiums and putting people back in charge of their health care decisions.
The breakthrough came when Michigan Congressman Fred Upton offered an amendment yesterday that would provide $8 billion for people with pre-existing conditions and announced he now supports the bill. Democrats mocked the GOP's challenge in getting enough support.
Now I have to say to my friends on the other side, you sold out cheap, as we say in New Jersey. The Upton Amendment is, of course, an admission. After 7 years, you came up with this? You got to be kidding me.
And others called out their Republican colleagues.
It takes real cojones to stand here and vote on a bill that they know provides nearly zero health care benefits for the American people.
Florida Congressman Brian Mast, who's a double amputee after military service in Afghanistan, noted he's someone with a pre-existing condition.
It is a responsibility for me to be the staunchest advocate for people out there that have pre-existing conditions, and that is why I'm such an ardent supporter of this bill.
House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi said Republicans walked the plank with this vote.
Our colleagues who have the mantle of being a moderate, you vote for this bill, you have walked the plank from moderate to radical. And you're walking the plank for what? A bill that will not be accepted by the United States Senate.
Now it goes to the Senate, where Republicans have a slim majority.
I sincerely hope, if this bill passes, I pray it doesn't, that the Senate won't mimic the House and try to rush a bill through without hearings or debate or analysis.
I don't think that the House bill necessarily predicts what is in the Senate bill. And we have only 52 senators. There has to be consensus.
The 20 Republican no's mostly came from moderates, some of whom represent swing districts that were won by Hillary Clinton, clearly concerned their political futures could be on the line with this vote. Chris?
Mike Emanuel reporting from Capitol Hill. Mike, thanks.
All right, so take a little pause here for local news. And we do have a little more West Montgomery, 623, 624, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, with Kelly O'Connell on KOBE, 523, 1450 to call in, and 805-6180. I think I have the text machine in the car, but we'll be giving you some local news right here. Macron in France takes a 24-point lead, so I guess Le Pen doesn't have much of a chance right now. And I am wondering if it was a mistake for her to attack him the way that he did, pardon me, the way that she did All right. Let's get into a segment here on Limbaugh's comparison of the old bill versus the new bill, Obamacare versus Trump care.
Simple language and explanation as I can make it. It's a side-by-side comparison of what was in Obamacare and what's changing, what's being kept, and what's being removed. Now, under Obamacare, the individual mandate requires people who can afford it to go out and buy health insurance. This House Republican bill repeals that. Kind of. Because there is a caveat. It is repealed. However, there are penalties in the House bill, the Republican bill, if you don't have insurance. Well, there are not penalties. The penalties that are in Obamacare would disappear. The change is that if you go uninsured for more than 63 days, you will have to pay a 30% surcharge on your premium when you get insurance. This is said to be an incentive designed to encourage people to maintain insurance coverage. So while they're repealing the individual mandate and repealing the penalties, they are replacing that with a proviso that you can't go longer than 2 months without coverage. Because if you, well, you can, but if you do, you're going to have a 30% surcharge added to your premium when you do get a policy. Now, some are going to think this is a distinction without a difference. You say you're repealing the individual mandate and repealing penalties, but then there's a penalty here if you don't have insurance. You can go 63 days without having a policy, and then if you do that, when you finally sign up and get insurance, you have a 30% surcharge on your premium. Now, they think the employer is going to bear the brunt of this. 159 people get their insurance from their employers still. One of the Obamacare objectives was to end that, and they were not able to make that happen fast enough. But getting you off your enrollment at your company would automatically direct you to an exchange or the government single payer. That's where they wanted Obamacare to go. Employer mandate. In Obamacare, the employer mandate required larger companies to provide affordable insurance to their employees. That has been repealed totally, and that's it. So employers no longer are required to provide affordable insurance to their employees. But that's not good, right? Well, it's going to work out because as job creation happens and employment ramps up, the competition for quality employees is going to result, and employers will sweeten the pot on the benefits side as incentives to people to sign up. So that theoretically will work out. Subsidies for out-of-pocket expenses under Obamacare, tax credits under Obamacare would be extended to help some people pay deductibles and co-payments. The House Republican bill repeals this in 2020. Not immediately. It repeals it in 2020. So the tax credits to help some people pay deductibles and make co-payments will remain. Taxes. Under Obamacare, there were new taxes on high incomes, new taxes on prescription drugs. There were taxes on medical devices, including indoor tanning salons, if you recall. The Republican bill repeals these. It rolls back the tax increases, which had been imposed under Obamacare to help pay for coverage expansion. So all those taxes are gone. New taxes on high incomes, taxes on prescription drugs, taxes on medical devices, indoor tanning. Gone. Medicaid expansion. Under Obamacare, more than 30 states expanded coverage by raising the eligibility cutoff to 138% of the poverty level. Now, on this one, we're definitely in the weeds here. And this to me is the epitome of what's wrong when the government gets involved in anything. What the hell is this? Medicaid expansion. Medicaid is welfare health care for the poor. More than 30 states expanded coverage with Medicaid by raising the eligibility cutoff to 138% of the poverty level. What this means is that whatever the poverty annual salary is, whatever the annual income that's called poverty is, 138% of that, you could still qualify for Medicaid. The states raised it in order to get more people qualified. Here's the way it changes in the Republican bill. Republican bill will let states keep the Medicaid expansion that they've engaged in and would allow states that expanded Medicaid to continue getting federal funding as they would have under Obamacare until 2020. Federal funding for people who became newly eligible starting in 2020 or who left the program and came back would be reduced. In other words, the amount of money available for newly arrived people under the state Medicare expansion, the money, the pool of money for those people would be reduced. States that have not expanded Medicaid already would not be allowed to do so in the future. The Republican bill also allows states to impose work requirements for some Medicaid beneficiaries. Remember, Medicaid is for the poor. Medicare is for our seasoned citizens. Medicaid the bill allows states to impose work requirements for some Medicaid beneficiaries. So if you're going to get Medicaid under the new Republican plan, you may have to work for it. It proposes capping federal funding per enrollee based on how much each state was spending in 2016. States also have the option to receive a lump sum block grant if they want. You following all this? You're following this. You can explain this to me. So what does this mean? You can't explain it, but you understand what I'm saying. Okay, cool. Pre-existing conditions policy. Under Obamacare, insurers were required to cover people regardless of pre-existing medical conditions. Obamacare prevents insurance companies from setting prices based on a customer's health history. Well, there you go. Whatever this is, that isn't insurance. I'm not trying to offend anybody. And you may think, so what if it's not insurance? We're not talking about insurance. We're talking about people being treated. We're talking about people being able to pay for it. Okay, fine. That's all that matters. Then Obamacare required insurers to cover people, whether they had pre-existing conditions or not, which is going to totally destroy. The reason it matters, folks, is because it blows the pricing structure out the wazoo. Obamacare bars insurance companies from setting prices based on a customer's health history, meaning they can't charge you more if you're always going to be sick.
That's right, Rush. That's only fair. That's...
No, it's not. But not if we're calling it insurance. Let's see, you're age 20, you go get a life insurance policy. It's going to cost you X because the tables say you're going to live 50 more years or 60. When you're 70 and go buy a life insurance policy, what do you think it's going to cost you? It's going to cost you a hell of a lot more because you're not going to be alive that much longer to pay premiums. So the risk is much greater that you're going to die at the time you take. So it's going to cost differently. That's how insurance works. This is not what this is. But I don't want to split hairs. Here's the change in the Republican bill. The Republican bill allows states to waive the rule restricting price differences based on health. That means that there can be price distinctions on people with pre-existing conditions, people in bad health, and people who are healthy. And that matters because this is how premiums are going to come down for healthy people, which is the vast majority of the people that we're talking about here. And this is one of the fundamental necessities of this bill is to bring down costs. This provision is the first step toward bringing down costs. Insurers would be allowed to charge higher prices to sick customers who had experienced a lapse in coverage of more than 63 days, as long as the state also set up a program to help high-risk patients obtain insurance. Another thing this does is, it's not farms it out, but it sends it to the states to handle this, because prices differ from state to state. Populations differ. Demographics all differ. So the state, remember, in any situation like this, the closer you can devise your solution to the root of the problem, the more efficient the solution. Why Washington should be coming up with a uniform, unilateral policy for everybody in every state is ridiculous. So letting the states handle this is also a mechanism for lowering premiums. In addition, in the Republican bill, it would add, and this is the light bulb guy's deal, would add $8 billion over 5 years to help people with pre-existing medical conditions in an effort to satisfy Republicans who voiced concern about the effects of these waivers. The light bulb guy thought that the relaxing of the waivers, meaning insurance companies can now charge different prices based on a person's health, which is... I need to be a law for that. The reason we do is because Obama blew that up. The light bulb guy thought, well, that's going to result in pre-existing condition people having to pay more. So we need more in the pool. So Trump said, okay, we'll throw $8 billion in there. And the light bulb guy and Billy Wong said, fine. Thank you for letting us twist your arm. And now I've got to take a brief time out. There's a little bit more here. Essential health benefits is a biggie. That's next.
All right, so anyway,
under Obamacare, a
little bit more from this.
Pre-existing condition costs were coming out of the premiums that everybody else paid. So that's one of the reasons premiums under Obamacare skyrocketed, is because that money was what was being used to pay for pre-existing conditions. And this is why Obama really sulked young people. The idea was young people, they're never going to make claims. They're healthy. They're never going to get sick. So just charge the hell out of them and use that money for the elderly, the sick, and pre-existing conditions. But young people said, screw it, I'll pay the penalty. I'm not sick. I'm not dumb. I don't have the money to pay this anyway. So it broke down. Now, under Obamacare, essential health benefits, this is where essential health benefits is where Obama really stacked the deck on Obamacare and was able, after the bill was passed, to just randomly choose things that he would require insurance companies to cover, such as maternity care, veterinary maternity care, insurance companies had to pay for sick debt, all kind of, whatever Obama wanted. This is how he made the Catholic Church have to pay for abortifacients, emergency services, preventative services, whatever Obama wanted the insurance companies to pay for, he threw in there. He did it via the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but they were called essential health benefits. In the Republican bill, states are allowed to waive all of that and set up their own standards. The Obama essential health benefits are gone, or will be, and that is another huge cost saving, because the insurance companies were raising premiums every time Obama said, you got to cover this, you got to cover that, Catholic Church has got to pay for.
All right, so that's kind of an overview. I don't know if you could follow that, but take another little break here. 642 AMLS Cruise the same 1450 523 1450. What do you think? Now it's got to go through the Senate. Now, so what happens in the health care bill? It goes on to the Senate, and here's a little bit from Representative Kevin Brady on how the Senate is going to treat it.
By the way, as a House Ways and Means Committee Chair, Congressman Kevin Brady. Congressman Brady, thanks for joining us.
Thanks,
Charles. Your quick thoughts on this bill, the executive order, President Trump is signing for religious liberty?
Yeah, I think it's important. Look, and in fact, we're going to go along that direction as well in the tax reform bill. We're going to include language that repeals the damaging effects of the Johnson Amendment so that it's pretty common sense, you know, allow our religious leaders to speak their faith and practice it without worrying about the IRS targeting them.
Yeah, I think anything that you can do to make the IRS no longer a weapon for the executive branch, it would be fantastic.
But I think so.
We all applaud this, and of course, it couldn't come on a better day, the day of the national prayer. But also
yes,
the day where maybe the House clears this big hurdle that, of course, last time there was a big stumble. How are you feeling about the votes right now?
Yeah, I feel very good, and especially since we got more news that in states like Iowa, 94 out of 99 counties won't even have an Obamacare provider next year. Look, this thing is collapsing. We've got to act to make healthcare more affordable and available. And so I feel good about the effort we're making today and moving it to the Senate.
How confident are you about the Senate? Bob Corker's already come out and essentially said it's dead on arrival.
Well, senators tend to say that, but in truth, look, there's a very good, solid group there that understands Obamacare is collapsing. They've got to act. In fact, here's my prediction is the Senate will take this up. In fact, we'll work to improve it. We've given them money to be able to target even better health care credits and for certain people. So I'm actually pretty optimistic that they'll continue to work and make it better.
All right. Here is from Representative Michael Burgess on the bill in the Senate.
To read the bill.
Is this too boring? I mean, I just wanted to cover the details.
Well, yeah, the bill was actually read. The base bill was read in committee a month ago when it was marked up in that 28-hour markup. The amendments, of course, have been two of the three have been available for several weeks, and the last amendment that was available last night was two pages. So, yes, those I have read all of those.
And what do you think?
How
of
are you
what,
feeling
what,
about that?
How are you feeling?
Well, look, I am a member of the authorizing committee that went through the 28-hour markup a few weeks ago, and I thought we had a good product that the committee produced. Remember, too, that this bill actually was passed in December of 2015 as a reconciliation bill, passed the House and the Senate, was vetoed by President Obama, and that, of course, was the base bill after the November 8th election. That was the base bill that we began working on in December of this year. I would just point out, too, I mean, you've had an election in 2010,
right.
One in 2014, one in 2016, where Obamacare was on the ballot,
right.
And the people spoke, and they wanted something done. So today is the first, or the next step in what is likely to be a very long process. I, like you, am anxious to see the fine minds over in the Senate get to work on this. They have leveled a lot of criticism at their House counterparts
right.
over the several months while we've been working on this. All right, fair enough. After 1 o'clock this afternoon, it will be on their docket.
Yeah, all right. So, are they going to pass it? It almost seems like they don't have a choice because Obamacare itself is so awful that it's got to be replaced by something, or the Republicans are going to get all of the blame. Now, here is on Steve Mossberg's show from Sally Pipes, how the health bill will undergo serious change in the Senate.
Bill, do you think we will eventually see what kind of changes to the House bill as it stands now? Where will those changes be, most severe when it gets to the Senate, do you believe? And then eventually back to conference.
Right. So if you look back at Obamacare, remember, not a single Republican voted for the law. But when it came out of the House, you know, and Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House at the time, and it went to the Senate, a lot of the things that the House wanted, like the public option, whether it be in a government-run insurance plan competing against private insurers, that was stripped out. They stripped out quite a bit. So I'll be interested to see what the Senate might do to this, because they're going to have to get 51 votes to pass the American Health Care Act. And I think the CBO is probably going to cost it out before it comes
before
out. I think the way this looks to me, it's going to be a lot more expensive. How are we going to make some of these amendments through budget reconciliation? It's not going to work. So I think they're going to have to make some serious changes to the American Health Care Act. But the age-based refundable tax credits are good because they're going to get rid of the Medicaid expansion. They're going to get rid of the subsidies. They're going to get rid of the employer and the individual mandate. I didn't like them slipping in on the AHCA that 30% subsidy that people who didn't keep their coverage were going to have to
pay. That means instead of paying a tax to the government, the insurance company will charge you 30% more if you have lapsed for over 60 days and that 60 some odd days.
66 days.
And then you're going to have to pay a bonus to the insurance company.
Right, exactly. And so that doesn't really get, in my mind, get rid of the individual mandate because it's another mandate giving insurance companies that, you know, that extra, you know, money for what they're doing. So, you know, we'll.
All right. So we'll take our last break here, and then I'm going to play for you the statement by Julia Brown. Was she treated fairly? Did she get screwed over? 523-1450. From what I understand, she had a lot of friends in the community, and there's a lot of people that are very upset at how she was treated. AM Las Cruces, we'll be right back. All right, here is Julia Brown on KVIA from yesterday, which apparently we'll start it right after this ad, but at least I got the clip going. And she says that commissioners never gave her a chance.
Former Diana County Manager Julia Brown is speaking out about her time in county government, along with her strained relationship with Sheriff Kiki Vigil. ABC 7's Jamie Warren joins us live from our New Mexico Mobile Newsroom. It's a story you'll see only on ABC 7.
And so the commissioner was fired Brown a week ago, but wouldn't say why. Brown has said that she believes it was because three of the newly elected commissioners made a deal with the sheriff. In an exclusive one-on-one interview you'll see only on ABC 7, Brown talks about their turbulent past.
Unfortunately, the instances where the sheriff and I have not agreed on things have become legendary.
In 2015, Brown handed Sheriff Kiki Vigil a restraining order in the middle of a news conference. It happened after Vigil announced a temporary jail takeover.
It was probably the only opportunity I would have to see him since he won't talk to me.
Brown now tells ABC 7 there were other times she and the sheriff lacked communication. She says once after having a meeting to purchase the department new vehicles.
The sheriff actually said that he had not had a meeting with me, that I refused to meet with him. And the people who were in the meeting and I were kind of looking around at each other in a perplexed fashion, trying to figure out if we'd enter the twilight zone.
Brown says she never tried to interfere with law enforcement, but says the sheriff was asking for more than the county could afford. She said after three new commissioners were elected.
And he said, well, I'm not going to worry about it. You won't be there much longer. When my three commissioners take office next year, they'll be getting rid of you. So then I'll be able to get everything I want.
Brown says she has no regrets during her time as county manager. She has a message for the people and employees who supported her.
Having seen the windows of opportunity opening and seeing light come in and shine and outshine the darkness that had been there before, I would urge them not to give up hope.
Yesterday, Sheriff Vigil told ABC 7 that he would go on camera to talk about this issue. But today, a sheriff spokesperson said he would not be commenting, stating it was, quote, a personnel issue. Previous low, Sheriff Vigil did tell ABC 7 that he had nothing to do with the firing of Julia Brown. Reporting live in Las Cruces with our New Mexico Mobile Newsroom, Jamie Warren, ABC.
Well, I mean, only the inside players know. Here's a little Jeff Allen on Fitbit.
I'm glad to be alive. I had a physical the first of the year. My wife, we normally take a vacation the first of the year. We go someplace warm.
And my wife decided to use that money this year to get us body, full physical, head to toe physicals. We spent all our money on physicals. So 2 weeks ago, I went to the doctor to get the results of my physical, and all he said was, if you were a wildebeest, you'd be dead. If you've ever watched Discovery Channel, the lions just sit there and wait for some crotchety old wildebeest. They always grab the last one that's just kind of coming up the rear. And that's what I would be. So she bought me a Fitbit. Apparently, my wife didn't think I was giving up enough of my privacy to Apple, Google, and the government. So what could go wrong with an American corporation monitoring my sleep habits, for God's sake? They tell me how many times I get up in the middle of the night. They send me text messages. I'm not asking for this. I want Golf Channel. Three, 4 weeks ago, Saturday afternoon morning, I get up, 10 o'clock in the morning, I turn on the Golf Channel. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Fitbit sends me a message. Are you dead? You've taken 78 steps in 4 hours. Apparently, 4 trips to the commode in my house is 78 steps. But you know what I found out? If you do this, you rack up the steps. So that's right. A few weeks ago, I'm in a hotel room. My wife called me. She says, what are you doing? I'm eating potato chips, right? I said, I'm running a 5K. Get off my back.
All right. So anyway, take you out with some Wes Montgomery. We'll be back after break on the hour. I got a ton more stuff. In the midst of this French race for president, 4chan, which is a kind of a strange channel where it's kind of a libertarian paradise, anything goes, and they love to go against the elites. They've posted images from Macron's offshore bank account, which could be devastating to his campaign if they turn out to be true. All right. Some of your headlines from the Google News: GOP cheers a big victory. The House has passed, has repealed and passed health care. And jobs are way up, 150,000 last month. And Obama gave his blessing to Macron. So I don't see a lot of real big news. There is a story here that is stating that the special forces in the governments, the military special forces, are being worked too hard, and that there are 8,000 special forces. Forces currently deployed in more than 80 countries, and that they are at the forefront of these missions, all the missions that we're doing out there. So I don't know if they're going to possibly, I guess what they need to do is get more of these people trained for the SEALs and stuff like that. All right, here I thought I would play for you. In the midst of a claim here that Obama's legacy is getting kind of flushed down the toilet, here's something from CNN.
One vote away now. So the pressure on those 5 Republicans, one of them has to walk the plank. Let's listen in.
Oh, there it is.
They hit 216.
That's
they hit 216 votes.
They can still change their minds, but as of right now, the 216 number has been achieved. The Republicans will declare victory at this stage. The president just tweeted, by the way, if victorious, Republicans will be having a big press conference at the beautiful Rose Garden of the White House immediately after the vote. And it looks like the Republicans have.
Yeah, they did. And it looks like those two Democrats who had looked like they voted for it changed their mind, probably a mistake there. And we'll see what this president says in terms of the messaging. It's a big moment for him. So many doubts in those first 100 days that he could get something done, and now he has.
All right, let's listen to the floor of the House.
The bill was passed. Obamacare was repealed and replaced. Now, what led up to this moment? Because it seems to me that Donald Trump is going for the gusto. He's going for the gold. And how did it all start? I believe from watching the video and what happened afterwards that it all started here in 2011. When Barack Obama went out of his way at the correspondence dinner to make fun of Donald Trump, who was present.
Someone should get to the bottom of that. And I know just the guy to do it. Donald Trump is here tonight. Now, I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier. No one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac? Kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, no, seriously, just recently in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night. Well handled. Say what you will about Mr. Trump, he certainly would bring some change to the White House. Let's see what we've got up there.
And then a picture of the Trump turned into one of the Trump Towers, the White House. Now, here is what President Obama said in September 17th, 2016, right before the election.
If you want to give Michelle and me a good send-off, and that was a beautiful video, but don't just watch us walk off into the sunset now. Get people registered to vote. If you care about our legacy, realize everything we stand for is at stake. All the progress we've made is at stake in this election. My name may not be on the ballot, but our progress is on the ballot. Tolerance is on the ballot. Democracy is on the ballot. Justice is on the ballot. Good schools are on the ballot. Ending mass incarceration, that's on the ballot right now. And there is one candidate who will advance those things. And there is another candidate whose defining principle, the central theme of his candidacy, is opposition to all that we've done. There's no such thing as a vote that doesn't matter. It all matters. And after we have achieved historic turnout in 2008 and 2012, especially in the African American community, I will consider it a personal insult, an insult to my legacy, if this community lets down its guard and fails to activate itself in this election. You want to give me a good send-off? Go vote. And I'm going to be working as hard as I can these next 7 weeks to make sure folks do. Hope is on the ballot. And fear is on the ballot, too. Hope is on the ballot, and fear is on the ballot, too.
Pretty remarkable, huh? Obama insults Trump on live TV, and then you've got this here from Seth Meyers, and they must have conspired ahead of time, right?
And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
So you got these two guys tag teaming Trump, and I think Trump is sitting there thinking, here you've got this guy that's not been a very successful president, who's got all of the support of the media, treating him like a god. Nobody ever criticizes him. As this book shows that just came out, or is about to come out, I should say, in 4 days, we really don't, to this day here, we really don't know that much about Obama, his history, the people that he hung out with and everything. Now in this book, the guy said that Obama talked about considering a gay relationship with his mentor and these other women that he had dated, et cetera. But we don't know what his grades were. We don't know what he was doing at certain points in his life. And the media has supported everything that he's ever done. And what was the result of that was spectacular failure. And now Trump comes along and he is taking apart his legacy piece by piece. It must be agonizing for Obama. 7:17, we'll be right back to switch gears a little bit on Venezuela, 523-1450. Live Tequila, Wes Montgomery. Playing with his own brothers. Venezuela is getting toward the end of a total collapse, and it is just absolutely staggering that one of the wealthiest countries in the world, the people are going to bed hungry every night, and they're having to kill vermin, rats, and eat their own pets to even get any protein. Here's a little bit from BBC News.
It doesn't take you long in oil-rich Venezuela to find this. Roadblocks by people saying they're struggling to get food.
As soon as we got off the car, people just started shouting and telling us that they're hungry, really.
These are desperate people inside a country where recent shortages and hyperinflation are hitting hard. This woman says that she sometimes goes to sleep crying because she hasn't been able to give her children any food.
This is what they're saying, they eat mangoes that they get from the tree, that's all.
Unsustainable public spending in the last decade has combined with a severe drop in the oil prices, leaving this crude exporting nation almost on its knees. Today, Venezuela has severe food shortages, and the inflation is expected to close this year at over 700%, leaving many unable to eat three times a day.
By the way, this is from July 2016, so about a year ago, and it's gotten much worse there.
This is plain rice.
Esa es la comida más fuerte del día.
And they're saying the only thing that they have to eat today is rice. That's all they have to eat. And the little kid there, his stomach is sticking out. It's kind of ballooned out like you see in the African children.
It's in the Zulia province where, ironically, oil was first discovered here.
¿Cómo se siente con esta situación?
No. No te voy a decir porque no hay nombre. Estamos viviendo lo que estamos viviendo todos, los venezolanos. Todos los venezolanos. ¿Ah?
¿Cuándo fue la última vez que comió?
Ayer.
¿A qué hora?
A las 3 de la tarde.
¿Y desde entonces nada?
Nada.
Agua.
Agua, paso, paso y agua que me bebió.
These are images been rarely seen outside of Venezuela.
Jamás en mis 8 años como pediatra y en mi edad de vida que tengo nunca.
Well, you've got a situation where you've got a country full of natural resources. The government takes everything over, and because the people in the government always have something to eat, right? They're living in nice houses. The military is taking the food that's delivered by the government, and then they're taking it and doubling, tripling, quadrupling the price, whatever, and getting a lot of the profit out of that. Now, there's going to come a point when the people are, you know, there's going to be some sort of a war. What's the war going to be over? Because the war is over a political famine from a failed economy that is directly caused by bad policy. It's the same ideas that Billy Garrett and Wayne Hancock used to open up a bus system that nobody wanted to ride on. And now, pathetically, the PVA is trying to double or triple the ridership to fool people again. It's sickening. Here's another one. Socialism nightmare. Venezuelans now eating dogs, cats, and pigeons to survive. And this is at the end of last year.
The eyes of Hugo Chavez looking over Caracas. But now he's dead. And the poor living there in the barrios, historically his political base, have turned against the movement he created.
Bread, medicine, toilet paper. These are just some of the basic necessities Venezuelans are struggling to find. The falling global oil prices have hit the country hard. Public services are disappearing one after the other. American officials are warning the country is on the brink of collapse.
Venezuela is in a state of emergency right now. Its currency has been devalued 92% since the last 2 years alone.
The amount of hyperinflation here is actually just unbelievable. You need a backpack full of money to buy a dinner.
Venezuela bet everything on the price of oil remaining high. And with government revenue 95% dependent on it, the plunge in oil has sent the economy reeling. As a result, GDP is predicted to contract 5.8% in 2016, the third straight year of negative growth. And Venezuela has the world's largest inflation rate, the IMF expecting it to reach 700% this year.
There were poverty reduction programs that were very much tied to political loyalty. They were not set up to be sustainable.
It started with a theory that capitalism is bad, a theory that private property and a division of labor is bad. One of the first things Hugo Chavez did was seize the land. He seized over 1,000 industrial enterprises, nationalizing them. He took over the energy grid. He took over the production of oil, which is today the only way that Venezuela generates revenue.
Now that oil prices are down and the government did not have the provision to save for rainy days, now Venezuelans are left with nothing in a country that only produces oil, that imports everything.
Venezuela could grow most of its own food thanks to large expansion of fertile land. But through the years, most of its agriculture has been abandoned, and other farms like this one have been expropriated by the government, and production has collapsed.
The government just lost control of the situation.
Last week, you'll remember President Nicolas Maduro had to hike petrol prices by 6,000%. So with all this, fears are growing that Venezuela soon won't be able to afford its debt repayments. In fact, bonds are already trading at levels that suggest a default is priced in.
Venezuelans in Caracas, in the capital city, we have a very tough time accessing basic necessities. But the people in the interior of the country, in the states, in the province, have it even worse. And we're not just talking about medicine. We're not just talking about basic things such as toilet paper. We're talking about food. And that's where the situation escalates.
Lines down the block for just basic necessities, line down the blocks for public transportation that is insufficient, you know, and then a lot of people talk about the toilet paper with the government setting up a set price so poor people could afford a toilet paper.
Even in the driving rain, Venezuelans started their day in search of food, expecting to see the usual grim queues that form at government stores. Not today. The only stores with affordable food are shut. Closed for the National Workers Holiday, the sign explains. It says sorry and thank you. People walked away empty-handed, but full of dread, wondering where their next meal might come from. And here's the thing. These people aren't allowed to come back tomorrow. Food is rationed here, doled out according to the last number on your government ID. Carlos Chirinos explains his turn is today. His number is 5.
Cinco.
So he's saying that just today and Wednesday can he buy things. And because it's closed today, he's out of luck.
The things that we have experienced, the things that we have seen here in Venezuela are absolutely insane.
We went to some of the restaurants, and all the prices on the menu are in paper, and they like taped onto the menu because they have to change it every week, and sometimes even more than that. It's changing that fast. It's really like it's interesting, and you brought up the gun-free zones. That's the most interesting part to me is no one is allowed to have a gun, and this is the murder capital of the world. So we walk into the hotel at night because we're a little crazy. We're told by everyone, don't go out, and we went out. There was no one anywhere. It was like a ghost town. And when we get back, the security guard is hiding behind a door because he doesn't have a gun, and the bad people all have guns.
The situation in Venezuela is dire. And it is dire in many different ways, socially, politically, as well as economically.
Yerma is a mother on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
That's the result of 5 days without water. This is how we live now, as Venezuelans. We've lost our quality of life.
We'll take a break here, but that is politically derived idiocy. They had farms across the country, they were abandoned because of policies. The bigger farmlands were taken over, the bigger enterprises taken over by the government. And what happens in a socialist country when the government takes over a business? Do they find the best people to run it? No, because the best people were already probably running it, and they've gotten rid of them. They go get one of their cronies and stick them in the job, and they don't know what they're doing, and the businesses are always destroyed. It is as inevitable as anything, as the changing of the seasons. It's inevitable that socialism and Marxism destroy economies. They destroy societies. They destroy individuals, and we're still dabbling with this garbage here in this community here. We're going to come back and talk about this a little bit more. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. Shame on you, Billy Garrett, for bringing up a failed bus line and pouring so much money into it and then trying to bring it back after they get rid of it. What is wrong with you? Shame on you. All right, here's from Jordan Peterson. He's a psychologist and a professor from up in Canada, and talking about how people get drawn into how they accept unacceptable change, the boiling frog strategy of Marxism.
And how this gets so far. I just don't understand how no one has, there's no rational thinking involved in the administration and the people that are implementing these ideas. I just don't understand how it gets to the point
where
things
get to terrible places one tiny step at a time. You know, if I encroach on you and I'm sophisticated about it, I'm going to encroach 2 millimeters. I'm going to encroach right to the point where you start to protest. Then I'm going to stop. Then I'm going to wait. Then you're going to calm down. Then I'm going to encroach again right to the point where you protest. Then I'm going to stop. Then I'm going to wait. And I'm just going to do that forever. And before you know it, you're going to be back 3 miles from where you started, and you'll have done it one step at a time. And then you'll go, oh, how'd I get here? And the answer was, well, I pushed you a little farther than you should have gone, and you agreed. And so then I pushed you a little farther than you should have gone again, and you agreed. And if anybody's interested in this sort of process, and this is a horrifying book, if you want to read about how this process works, you can read a book called Ordinary Men by Robert Browning. And Ordinary Men is about, Browning was interested in how the Nazis trained how they train people to kill, basically. And so Robert Browning studied this police battalion. It's a very interesting book. So these were middle-aged German men. So they were raised and educated really before Hitler came to power. So they weren't indoctrinated Nazis. They were policemen. And when the Nazis went through Poland and then needed to impose their brand of order on Poland, they brought policemen in. They brought this battalion of middle-aged policemen in. And their commandant, their commander, was by all accounts a pretty decent guy. And he told them that because it was wartime, they were probably going to have to do some pretty terrible things, but that they could go home if they didn't think they were up to it. So there was no compulsion. You know, this wasn't a Milgram experiment or an experiment where you had to obey orders. The guy who was giving the order said, look, this is going to be awful, but you can back off. But the guys thought, well, I'm not going to leave my comrades here to do the dirty work, you know, which is kind of a virtue in a perverse way. And then Browning details how they went from ordinary policemen to guys who were taking naked pregnant women out into the middle of fields and shooting them in the back of the head. And they were physically ill during most of the transformation process. You know, they started out by rounding up the Jewish men between the ages of 16 and 65. Well, you know, you can kind of understand that because you're at war. And then, well, then they put them in stadiums. And then, well, then they had to shoot some of them. And then they had to load them on cattle cars. It was like one step at a time. These guys were having a dreadful time of it. They didn't stop. And so that's how things get to where they are now, is that, I mean, I know they're not at that point, and I'm not trying to make the case that they're at that point. Well, you're one of...
Interesting stuff, huh? I have got your weather for you right here, and we'll be right back. All right, here's carrying on here. Here's a little bit from the Prager University, Dennis Prager, on socialism makes people selfish.
In the contemporary world, it's taken as a given that capitalism, with its free market and profit motive, is based on selfishness and produces selfishness, while socialism is based on selflessness and produces selflessness. Well, the opposite is true. Whatever its intentions, socialism produces far more selfish individuals and a far more selfish society than a free market economy does. And once this widespread selfishness catches on, it is almost impossible to undo it. Here's an illustration. In 2010, the United States President Barack Obama addressed a large audience of college students. At one point in his speech, he announced that young people will now be able to remain on their parents' health insurance plan until age 26. I don't ever recall hearing a louder, more thunderous, or more sustained applause than I did then. Had the president announced that a cure for cancer had been discovered, it is highly doubtful that the applause would have been as loud or as long. But what were they so happy about? To be told that you can now remain dependent on your parents until age 26 should strike a young person as demeaning, not liberating. Throughout American history, and for that matter, all of Western history, the great goal of young people was to become a mature adult, beginning with being independent of mom and dad. Socialism and the welfare state destroy this aspiration. In various European countries, and now increasingly in the U.S., it is becoming common for young people to live with their parents well into their 30s and not infrequently beyond. And why not? In the welfare state, taking care of yourself is no longer a virtue. Why? Because the government will take care of you. Therefore, socialism enables, and as a result produces, people whose preoccupations become more and more self-centered. How many benefits will I receive from the government? Will the government pay for my education? Will the government pay for my health care? What is the youngest age at which I can retire? How much paid vacation time can I get? How many days can I call in sick and still get paid? How many weeks of paid paternity or maternity leave am I entitled to? The list gets longer with every election of a liberal or progressive or left-wing party. And then each entitlement becomes a right. But we're not done. There are even more destructive effects of socialism. Entitlements create citizens who lack a character trait that every human should have: gratitude. You cannot be happy if you are not grateful, and you cannot be a good person if you're not grateful. That's why we constantly tell our children, say thank you. But socialism undoes that. After all, why would a person be grateful for receiving an entitlement? Who's going to be grateful for getting what they're entitled to? So instead of thank you, the citizen of the welfare state is taught to say, what more am I entitled to? Yet the left insists that it's capitalism and the free market, not socialism, that produces selfish people. But the truth is that capitalism and the free market produce much less selfish people. Teaching people to work hard and take care of themselves and others, and that they should earn what they receive, produces less selfish, not more selfish people. Capitalism teaches people to work more. Socialism teaches people to demand more. Which attitude do you think will make a better society? I'm Dennis Prager.
If you were going to start, if you had a plan to start a society that would become a great empire, would you start it on capitalism or socialism? I know I've asked that before, but here is, remember this, I think her name was Peggy Joseph, an Obama supporter, talking about her most memorable day ever in 2008, October.
Peggy Joseph took her daughter out of school early Wednesday for this. Her emotions ran high following Obama's speech.
It was the most memorable time of my life. It was a touching moment because I never thought this day would ever happen. I won't have to worry about putting gas in my car. I won't have to worry about paying my mortgage. You know, if I help him, he's going to help me.
Wow. Holy cow. All right. We'll take... Well, I actually have another clip for you that I think you'll find interesting. Do you believe we're talking about this society being taken over by socialism, socialistic ideas, Marxism, and that type of thing? In Venezuela, they just made the transition in a couple of decades, and it is just a absolute nightmare now. It is like a giant prison. And in this country, we've become more and more government-oriented. And I hear people talk all the time about how entitled people are. And so we're getting enculturated to see things from more of a socialistic way, even though Trump has just now stood up. So do you think if you were put in a situation, say you were in Germany, that you would have fought against the Nazis? Basically, everybody that I know would say, yes, of course I would have fought against the Nazis. I'm a good person. Killing people is wrong. You know, killing Jews is wrong. Of course I would have fought, not knowing what the history of the country was at all. Here is, again, Jordan Peterson saying it's unlikely that you would have stood up against them.
On Auschwitz, and I was trying to understand it. I think maybe I tried to understand it in a way that was somewhat different than most people who examine historical events, because I was trying to understand how human beings could do that, knowing full well that I was one of them. And that's the critical thing, because generally when people examine, especially something horrifying that's done by humanity, they make the assumption that it's other people doing it. And that's a big mistake in my estimation, because if a lot of human beings have done something terrible, you can be sure that being a human being, that you're capable of it. And, you know, one of the things that we've been asked repeatedly to do as a consequence of what happened in World War II is to not forget it. But it's always been my contention that you can't remember something you don't understand. And you don't understand what happened in Nazi Germany or in the Soviet Union, for that matter, until you understand that had you been there, the probability that you would have played a role and that wouldn't have been a positive one is extraordinarily high. When people do think about themselves as actors in situations like that, they have a proclivity to cast themselves in a heroic role, assuming that had they been, say, in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, that they would have taken on the burden of fighting against the Nazis and defending the things that should have been defended. But that's a very foolish presupposition, especially because it's more or less self-evident from the historical perspective that that isn't what people did. And in order for us to come to terms with that, it means that we have to understand how it happened, but more importantly, what role we still play as individuals in acting in such a way that such things are not only likely, but desired.
Okay, so here's the last break that we have. Kind of scary, isn't it? The direction things are heading. I mean, Trump seems to be pushing against it, but they've kept a lot of stuff in the new healthcare bill that was in the old bill that was complained about. So who knows what direction it's really heading. 7:50 a.m. Las Cruces, 523-1450 on KOBE. We'll be back to finish up these ideas. Well, we don't really have time to get into the last thing that I was going to play here for you, which was the thing from Richard Dreyfuss. I found a TED Talk, you know, how they have these TED Talks on YouTube, and talking about civics. And, well, maybe I'll do a little five-minute clip of this thing. Have to have an ad first, so 4 minutes of it. But civics, the way forward, the way to save ourselves is to get educated on what it means. I think there should be a law in America against socialism and Marxism. There should be a law that teaches people economics and why socialism always fails. I know that's maybe sounds like overkill, but all right, here's Richard Dreyfuss. Ted San Diego.
Call of Duty. Hi. I am here today as an advocate for a critical piece of education that has been purposefully removed from our schools today. This missing link is the reason for the uneasy feeling we all share now about what's happening in America. We call the subject civics, which is, fundamentally important because it's governance. With the slightest shift of perception, civics can go a long way to repairing all of our current insolvable problems, which are not insolvable, and wake people up to their solution and prepare them to achieve the mobility of mind that is the goal of education. Why civics? Why do we call our War of Independence a revolutionary war? Why? It wasn't independence, because there are more struggles for independence than you can count. It was because we, the people of the nation, were asked to run the nation. It is the only class, civics, in which that is taught, that the ruler and the ruled could be one thing. It teaches our children how to run the country before it's their turn to run the country. It teaches the citizens of the country that they are the final authority, that they are the ones to be answered to. And civics should teach realistic, practical political power. Not empty words, but with the full powers of the Constitution and the legal authority that stems from it. America is revolutionary because education was never, ever, ever done for the common man. Ever offered, even to read or write, because it created frustration and a desire to change one's station. The higher classes never deny education to their young, but never allow it to 95% of the people who have lived on the planet Earth. Educating all to all was truly revolutionary. And it would have gotten us hanged if we'd been a European country. The Constitution and its preamble make no mention of political parties, but political parties have become the center of our political process. And even the simplest study of civics teaches that the Constitution is the center. And some things cannot be solved through a partisan filter. You can't have a Republican Party highway system. You can't have a Democratic Party education system. Some things are shared by all and must be solved by all as Americans. The Constitution, however, has become a supporting player. And that is counter-revolutionary. The Bill of Rights is revolutionary because it's more than a series of laws and responsibilities. It is a picture of our future moral character. We had the courage to say, this is who we choose to be. By signing it and making it public, the whole world knows every time we fail it and every time we succeed it. That is the ultimate American gesture, because it was naive and it was profound. And it described not what the people were restrained from doing, it was restrained from doing to its own people. And that is revolutionary to the core. It is unique, dangerous, and beautiful.